So, good afternoon. It's nice to start the Easter term Friday lectures on this sunny afternoon with Professor Timothy Mayer, who is a professor of law, FedEx research professor, and director of the International Legal Studies Program at Vanderbilt Law School. Tim is an expert in public international law, specializing in trade, investment law, and international energy governance. He's published in several very prestigious law journals in the US, including Columbia, University of Pennsylvania, California Law Review, Vanderbilt Law Review, and the Journal of Legal Analysis, and also in the European Journal of International Law for us international lawyers. He's an author of a book coming up with the OUP with Andrew Gassman on international soft law. And Tim will speak today about foreign affairs and the national security economy.
Thank you, Professor Venisi, for that introduction and for having me here. Thanks to you all for coming. It's a gorgeous day, and so it's perhaps not the easiest to be inside. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming. So, as I think many of you may be aware, the importance of national security to trade and investment relations has spiked in recent months or years. The item that tends to catch, or the action that tends to catch most people's eye, has been the Trump administration's imposition of tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. The administration has imposed a 25% tariff on steel imports and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports. As a matter of U.S. law, this is done pursuant to an authority called Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act. It will be, whenever WTO panels get around to hearing it, justified under GATT Article 21, or the administration will attempt to justify it under GATT Article 21. There may be, although there hasn't been a dispute filed yet, one could imagine a NAFTA claim, a North American Free Trade Agreement claim, that would the U.S. would presumably defend on a similar exception to NAFTA. That would be an investment claim presumably brought probably by a Canadian investor, although it would be possible for it to be a Mexican investor as well. And the Trump administration has actually, they're very creative. They have lots of products that they thought that they might be able to use Section 232 on. And so the current product that they essentially have in their pocket is autos and auto parts, which would be used probably to target Europe. And so the president is in possession of a report that, although it's not public, we presume recommends the imposition of tariffs on autos on national security grounds. One of my favorite quotes comes from a hearing on the possible imposition of tariffs when a trade association for the auto manufacturers said, "The United States does not go to war in a Ford Fiesta." Which is a small car, right? There's no, or seemingly no, national security justification for these kinds of trade actions. We can think of other kinds of national security justifications. One that is sweeping through the world now, including in Europe, of course, is the battle over the security of the 5G system and the extent to which you should keep out. I'm never quite sure how the name of this company is properly pronounced, Huawei. And the control of the 5G network should be essentially monitored for national security considerations. So a lot of people have started to think about what this means. Are we at a new point in terms of the intersection of national security and trade and economic relations? And there's a sense in which both of these two have been pillars of the international systems in the post-war era. The GATT, the original ITO, and the Bretton Woods system was established in part to make sure that trade and economic relations were not the cause, of course, of a third world war. And there was a sort of a parallel sort of set of institutions that were designed to take on the task of economic liberalization. Standing outside the trade system, the purpose was, in a sense, to promote peace and security and national security. And of course, national security continued to run along as a parallel consideration in every country and at the UN, the UN level. What I want to talk about today, I want to make sort of two arguments. I want to suggest that the current moment reflects a sharpening of a trend that existed previously throughout the Cold War era. And that is that there's a basic distinction between countries that invoke national security in the trade. So I'm going to talk mostly about the trade context, although we can think about the broader economic law context. That invoke this, you can think about invoking it on a product basis or on a nation-specific basis. And during the Cold War, we saw countries, especially the United States, invoke it for both reasons. It was invoked to regulate products, and it was invoked to regulate commerce with individual nations. And I think this distinction makes a lot of sense of both what happened up to now, as well as the current moment. And I want to suggest that although there's a tendency to think that what is happening now is that there's a lot that's new in the way in which the national security concept is being applied to economic relations, that perhaps there isn't quite as much new in this vein as it might seem that there is. The second thing I want to suggest is that there has been a shift, though, in, and this is the foreign relations piece, in the way in which executive branches use trade policy as a tool of foreign policy. And that the way that it was used in the Cold War was much more in the service of promoting peace and stability, and now it's used much more as a tool of domestic economic policy. And I think, again, this is very clear in the policies of the Trump administration. The president does seem to like to use anything he can find to irritate people he doesn't like and to pick on countries he doesn't like. But a lot of what he's doing, the president probably doesn't get enough credit for being quite politically astute, even if his tactics are in many cases undesirable or even deplorable. He doesn't get enough credit probably for being politically astute and understanding the ways in which his policies do promote political support for him within the U.S. system, because they target constituencies within the United States that perceive themselves, rightly or wrongly, to benefit economically from his policies. So that's the descriptive part of what I want to talk about. And then I want to talk a little bit normatively about the problem of national security exceptions. And I want to suggest that we have basically three, at least three roles for exceptions in international law. And part of the problem we're seeing with the invocation of national security as an exception to trade is that we haven't really thought through what I'm going to call the channeling function of the national security exception as it relates to the kinds of distributional, economic distributional and fairness considerations that are at the heart of both the Trump administration's appeals, but also the appeals of some Eurosceptic groups in the EU, and in the United States, actually, at the heart of campaigns like Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign or Elizabeth Warren's campaign. So it has a flavor of being in some countries, and this is certainly true in the United States, of being a right-wing movement, but it is also actually a left-wing movement, at least in the United States. So that's sort of the roadmap of what I want to talk about. I want to descriptively talk about what is and isn't different about national security as it's applied to trade relations. And then I want to talk a little bit about the role of exceptions and how we might think about reformulating a functional national security exception that's not prone to the same kinds of abuse that the current exception might be prone to. So to start, for those of you who are trade lawyers, you will have probably run and read the panel report in the dispute involving Russia and Ukraine. There are a series of disputes at the WTO in which the Article 21 exception for national security has been invoked. I don't want to spend a lot of time parsing the exception and the way it works in this talk, but suffice it to say that in two of those, They at least sound like things we might normally associate with national security. This is the dispute between Russia and Ukraine, and then the dispute in the Middle East involving Qatar. The panel report in the Russia dispute was the first to hit, and is relevant for this talk. The dispute looks at a series of invocations of the national security exception that follow from the GATT in 1947, and it looks at them as subsequent practice to try to determine whether or not there has been any agreement among the parties about the way in which the exception in Article 21 should be interpreted. The panel ultimately concluded that there wasn't any subsequent agreement evidenced by the practice that it canvassed. But I think for those of us who are thinking about these kinds of problems, it's actually a really useful list of examples in which Article 21 has been invoked, because most of us tend to think about Article 21 being invoked in disputes. But in fact, Article 21 is much more frequently invoked diplomatically in the Council or in the various committees at the WTO. And so the panel report gives us a nice overview of how that exception has been invoked in that context. And I think you can see the following basic distinction, which is the distinction I suggested earlier, a distinction between times in which countries have invoked a product-specific justification, they are regulating a product, and situations in which they have invoked it with respect to particular countries. Now this isn't a totally sharp, I don't want to pretend this is a totally sharp distinction, because sometimes it's invoked with respect to a product, for example, oil, that clearly is associated with a certain set of countries. Sometimes it is invoked with respect to a particular product from a particular country, so sugar from Nicaragua, for instance. I think we can think of that as being really targeted at Nicaragua and not so much at sugar. But it's not a totally sharp distinction. But I think you can see something very useful that sheds light on the current moment if you think about this discussion. Now, Ben Heath has written a very important article that'll be coming out in the Yale Law Journal probably next year, although it's available online, that sort of starts trying to make the argument that we are seeing this invocation of national security in all of these new contexts. And it is certainly the case that we are seeing the invocation of national security in very, very prominent ways. But I think what we're really seeing is that we're seeing the invocation of national security much more in the context of product-type regulations rather than nation-like regulations. So during the GATT period, during the Cold War, you saw the United States invoke Article 21 for measures taken against Czechoslovakia, several different measures taken against Nicaragua in the 1980s, to justify the embargo on Cuba. You saw the EC, the British, invoke it with respect to Argentina. We have seen the EC invoke it with respect to Yugoslavia. These were all trade measures that really had nothing to do with trade. They were primarily aimed at solving some other problem that was essentially a foreign relations law problem. In some cases, these were actual conflicts that related to peace and security. So we can think of Argentina, we can think of Yugoslavia. In other cases, these involved more sort of spheres of influence or attempts in some cases by the United States to interfere, if you will, in the internal politics of countries like Cuba or Argentina. But these were not primarily about trade. And one of the interesting things you see in all of these disputes when the United States or usually a European country is discussing in the Council at the GATT why they're invoking Article 21, they're very careful to say that they're invoking Article 21. They basically disclaim any economic motivation. The United States is particularly clear in the early years to say, look, this is not really about trade, and therefore the GATT should basically get out of the business of looking at this. And you see some actually very interesting actions taken by the United States on that basis. The United States does not, in many of these cases, actually even dispute that it is violating the GATT. It doesn't even bother with that. It just says, look, this isn't about trade, and therefore We're invoking Article 21. In some of the instances, they don't even bother to invoke Article 21. They just say, look, the council shouldn't be involved in assessing these kinds of situations. And the place that I think this really comes through is in the first Nicaragua dispute. There's two disputes between the United States and Nicaragua. The first, the earlier, involves just sugar. And then the second involves more widespread embargo on trade with Nicaragua, both on an import and an export basis. And so there is a panel that finds basically that the U.S. has violated the GATT with respect to measures restricting the import of the United States of Nicaraguan sugar. And the United States says, you know, we have no this is right. We have no objection to the adoption of this report. This is during the GATT years in which a GATT panel report could be blocked by one member. So the United States was probably in a position to block the adoption of the report. And it said we have no objection to it. This is clearly right. It also clearly has nothing to do with trade. I want to suggest that if you have studied WTO law, that this is within this WTO space, within the trade law space, this is highly, highly objectionable. This is almost the most objectionable kind of trade measure we can have because it violates what is GATT Article 1. It violates the most favored nation principle. You are using a trade measure to discriminate specifically against another country in a way that is targeted at getting, basically coercing them to adopt some policy or perhaps to induce governmental change. That is the kind of thing that within the trade space, absolutely you are not supposed to be doing. I also, though, want to suggest that within the larger space of geopolitics, this is probably the least controversial use of the national security exception, because these are, whether or not they are national security exceptions in the sense that was Nicaragua really threatening the security of the United States, this seems unlikely. It was a real genuine foreign policy concern of the United States or of the European communities with respect to Argentina or with respect to Yugoslavia. You are facing what the leaders of those institutions, the domestic institutions, felt to be a sincere crisis that required a response. And one of the tools they reached for was the tool of economic relations. So you see, I think, immediately there a sort of a disconnect between the way in which trade and more general foreign policy considerations interact. The thing that is most objectionable within the trade space, discriminating against specific nations, the thing that is Article 1 of the GATT, the United States wanted the MFN provision to be Article 1 of the GATT precisely because it wanted to get rid of things like British colonial preferences, where you would privilege or punish individual nations. That remains through the Cold War period outside of the WTO space, the GATT space. It remains the kind of most acceptable form of use of the national security kind of exception. And if you read through these cases, you'll see it's not just the United States that takes this view, that there are a number of countries, again, mostly European countries, but not entirely European countries, that weigh in to take this view as well. This is not something that the GATT should really be involved in, that when there are larger foreign policy considerations, those foreign policy considerations basically operate to take the dispute out of the GATT, which doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a GATT violation. And so the question of whether or not there was a GATT violation and what kind of rights were retained by the countries that had were aggrieved in these instances was a separate question. But the question that was sort of off the table was the question of whether or not we should condemn the motives of the country within the GATT, whether we should condemn the motives of the country that was acting. There are other instances during this time period, though, that are product-specific, and there are fewer of them, but they exist, and they're the ones that trade lawyers know because they're sort of weird, and they often don't make sense, right? So Sweden had a measure with respect to footwear that it tried to justify on national security grounds. It said that the Swedish, I believe if I remember correctly, the Swedish army was not going to have enough rubber boots if they didn't boost domestic production of footwear in Sweden. So they maintained some restrictions on import measures, and this struck people as basically ridiculous. And Sweden was pressured to withdraw that measure. Austria maintained restrictions on medicines in order to boost domestic production of certain kinds of medicines. And actually, they maintained that right up until the 1990s, when they gave it up under pressure from U.S. pharmaceutical companies in the context of the Uruguay Round negotiations to create the WTO. The United States also maintained import restrictions with respect to oil during the 70s. This is a harder case. There, during, of course, the 1970s, there was at one point an embargo on trade in oil with the United States from OPEC countries. But some of these import restrictions basically predate that, and they were actually imposed under the same authority that the steel tariffs today are being imposed under. And there was a fairly strong claim in the early 1970s by Canada as well as by Europe that this was a measure that was basically being maintained in order to privilege domestic production. There's a sense in which these kinds of product-specific regulations were less troubling within the WTO space because they weren't as big, right? You weren't targeting a country. If you want to think of it this way, if nation-based regulation or invocation of national security is an MFN issue, these are really national treatment kinds of issues, right? You're trying to privilege a domestic interest. There wasn't really a domestic interest in the U.S. or a major one that was benefiting from restrictions on Nicaraguan sugar. Cuba, likewise, doesn't really affect. It's not big enough to affect the United States on any kind of grand scale. Once you shift to products, you're not necessarily affecting anything on the same kind of scale that invokes that causes countries like Nicaragua or Cuba to object strenuously. But you are also hitting many, many more countries than you are if you target only a single country. And so what I want to suggest is that what we have seen is, to some extent, the decline of the invocation of the national security exception in a nation-specific way. It hasn't gone away. Obviously, Russia and Ukraine are invoking it in that way. It's being invoked in that way in the Middle East dispute. But we're seeing much more significant invocations, much more, if you will, sort of economically systemic invocations of national security on a product-specific basis. Steel is a commodity that is central to any industrial economy. Aluminum, actually, it turns out that aluminum is much more important for national security purposes than steel. So aluminum, also very important. And autos that the president has had in his back pocket are critical to the economies of many industrialized nations, both in North America and in Europe, and of course in Asia as well. So autos are really, I think, going to be the test case for this. And I want to suggest that maybe what is changing is a greater comfort with certain elements of the international, let's call them international lawyers that are actually in power in certain countries, in invoking national security on a product basis rather than a country-specific basis, where I think there's always been a high degree of comfort with invoking the exception. The second thing that I just want to talk about a little bit descriptively is why it is that the executive branches in countries are more comfortable invoking national security on a product-specific basis. And I think to get a little grasp on this, we have to think about the fact that, again, starting in 1947 or coming out of the war, the executive branch has really understood, and part of the project of building the kind of Bretton Woods system and what ultimately became the GATT system, was that we were going to, at the start, the idea was to help rebuild, particularly rebuild here in Europe. But the idea was also later, of course, to act as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. And this is quite clear if you look in debates within the U.S. Congress, when the Congress is approving trade agreements. It's quite clear if you look at speeches that were given by Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy, who were very formative in terms of seeking authority and ultimately negotiating the early GATT agreements. The construction of a free trade regime was justified basically on the grounds that it was going to help the United States win the Cold War. And there are some odd cases where Congress is doesn't have necessarily this, the U.S. Congress doesn't, or any legislature really, doesn't necessarily have this sort of this global perspective. We often talk about this in trade, but this is true in foreign policy generally, that if you represent a particular district, you're the MP from Cambridge, or you're the senator from Iowa, you're interested in the sort of parochial interests of your constituency. And this leads to odd results. So one of the national security cases from the early 1950s is that our Congress just passed a law that said that we were going to restrict dairy imports on grounds of national security. So there was milk. We needed milk for national security. And the executive branch went to the GATT party. Lots of complaints at the GATT, and the executive branch went to the GATT and said, look, this is clearly a GATT violation. We're very sorry about this. We are going to get our Congress to fix the problem, and just bear with us while we try to educate these slightly dim-witted members of our Congress who are just trying to protect dairy farmers in Wisconsin, right? They don't understand that these domestic economic issues need to take a backseat to the foreign policy priorities that underlie the construction of this free trade regime. You see the executive branch taking that, the U.S. executive branch taking that position over and over again through the 1950s and the 1960s. By the end of the Cold War, the foreign policy justification for a trade regime is much weaker. And into the 1990s and 2000s, the foreign policy justifications for further trade liberalization, I don't mean the existing trade regime, I mean further trade liberalization, foreign policy is regularly invoked, but usually as a fig leaf. And the clearest example of this is the Obama administration's efforts to justify the Trans-Pacific Partnership as encircling China. Right, President Obama went around talking about how the United States was going to write the rules of the road for the 21st century through the TPP. The TPP, if you looked at it, it turned out didn't look that different from just a cut-and-paste job from prior U.S. Trade agreements. And Kathleen Clausen has done a lot of good work on the sort of boilerplate nature of U.S. trade agreements. So there were some fairly hard-fought provisions, but most of those hard-fought provisions actually involve rent-seeking. So and this is coming up in the efforts to ratify the new NAFTA as well. Pharmaceutical companies, right, want want extra IP protections. They want to get it through these agreements. It's hard to justify those as being meaningful to the sort of economy of the United States on any kind of grand scale, right? It's really just sort of rent seeking. And so what you saw in the post-Cold War period, and I think you've seen this globally, you certainly have seen this in the U.S. conduct of trade foreign of trade policy, is that the foreign policy rationale that kept the executive branch operating on a global-minded basis has basically collapsed. And the executive branch, I want to suggest that President Trump is not new to this game, that President Bush did this and President Obama did this as well, what they have started to do is, because the foreign policy considerations, the general foreign policy considerations, the peace and security role that the trade regime plays, is less important in today's world, they have felt freer to use trade policy to protect favored domestic constituencies. And again, just to give you another example, this is not just Trump, of course. Bush did the exact same thing with steel that Trump has done in the early 2000s in his first term in office. And he did it for the exact same reason. He did it to try to shore up political support in the Rust Belt of the United States. He invoked a different, somewhat less controversial legal theory. So it was a safeguards, what was called a safeguards measure. It wasn't a national security measure. And the European Union immediately filed a dispute. And upon winning, was prepared to retaliate. And at that point, the system operated the way it was supposed to operate, and the Bush administration backed down. But I offer this just to suggest that Trump is an extension of a trend that has been going on since the Cold War, that the removal of these foreign policy imperatives to liberalize trade has freed the executive branch to think in terms of the same kinds of parochial interests that legislators have been thinking in for decades. And that is what is feeding this sort of product-specific invocation of national security, that presidents are much more, presidents, prime ministers, much more comfortable with product using national security as a paradigm to regulate trade generally, because they're looking much more to domestic politics than they are to foreign policy. So in what is about 10 or so minutes left, I want to shift gears now to the normative component of the talk and just suggest how we think about this problem. And I want to say something about the what are the possible functions of exceptions in international law. And my thinking on this subject is somewhat tentative, so I'll look forward to questions or comments or suggestions that you all might have. I think we can think of there as being basically three kinds of roles, or at least three kinds of roles, that exceptions play in international law. And I'm thinking here of GAP 21, the national security exception. I'm also thinking, though, of, I'm thinking of exceptions generally, but I'm also thinking of the domestic statutes that implement those exceptions, that give the kind of authority to usually the executive branch to implement those exceptions without having to go back through the legislature. So in the United States, this Section 232 is a statute that the United States says, when asked, just implements GAT 21 and gives the authority to the president to take measures that are consistent with GAT 21. Now, the first function that I think we can think of these kinds of exceptions in economic law playing is what is basically a policy space kind of function, right? And this isn't probably the most familiar way to think about the role of at least the general exceptions in, for instance, GATT Article 20. The idea is that there are a variety of non-trade or non-economic considerations that we think governments need to have some latitude to pursue, even if the ways in which they pursue those measures are in some tension with the trade regime. And so, of course, the way this normally works is that if you bring a trade dispute, if you win the dispute, right, if you're the complainant and you win, you show that the measure is, for instance, discriminatory, and then the burden shifts to the respondent to justify the measure under the exception that it falls within the scope, and then, of course, has to not be unjustifiably or arbitrarily discriminatory even in its application under GATT Article 20. For us lawyers, this is the meat of the exceptions, right? Because when we get with our colleagues, I used to be a lawyer for the U.S. State Department, so when we talk with our colleagues at other foreign ministries, this is the language we speak in. We speak in terms of what kind of space does the exception create for measures that are not compatible with the primary obligations. In this case of the GATT, although I think that for this part of the discussion, we could be talking about any area of international law. Maybe this is also something that higher level officials consider within foreign ministries. Certainly if they're taking advice of counsel, they are thinking in these kinds of terms. But in at least some instances, I want to suggest, it's not obvious that the higher level officials care about this really at all. And so it's not obvious, and again, I'll just refer to the United States, that if the internationally problematic measure is enacted by the legislature, it is not clear that the legislature paid any attention to the fact that it was going to get into trouble internationally. It was going to put the United States in trouble internationally. And so it is well understood within the U.S. State Department or the U.S. Trade Representative's Office that if there is a measure that has been adopted, a regulation that has been adopted by the executive branch that is internationally incompatible with some international obligation, we can go try to fix that. If it has been adopted by a legislature, we have a much bigger problem because getting the legislature to change some policy it has adopted because it's incompatible with international agreement can be quite difficult. Sometimes there's success at doing it, but it can be quite difficult. And God forbid if it should be a local government that did it. Because then you have a real problem. I once talked to a colleague of mine that was litigating the Boeing Airbus disputes. And these are disputes, for those who don't know, that involve basically massive government subsidies that occur in both the United States and in Europe for Boeing and Airbus. And in the United States, many of these subsidies are actually not federal subsidies. They're actually state-level subsidies, particularly from the government of Washington, the state of Washington. And I said, well, what do you say to the state of Washington when you lose? You know, you get the Penn report comes out and says, oh, the state of Washington has you know, given these illegal subsidies. And she said, you can't. We call them and we fly out to Seattle and we try to tell them there's this thing called the WTO, and they remember when there was riots in the streets of Seattle about this, but they basically don't care. Because partially this is a function of rules of state responsibility, right? Is that it is the federal government's problem to deal with it. And so the state of Washington more or less doesn't care what the answer is. So all that is to say, we have this policy space justification, but I think the policy space justification, it works. It does some real world work in the sense that lawyers do speak in this language, and there are going to be contexts in which it is going to operate to enable or constrain action by governments. But I think in really important cases, this is not what's doing a lot of work within the international legal system. States are not responding to this kind of policy-enabling framework that exceptions create. The second function you can think of is what we might think of as a loss avoidance function. And so just briefly to explain loss avoidance, if you think about the way remedies work in the international system, they are usually not zero-sum. So that you usually do not get full compensation for the losses you have suffered when a country has violated your rights, trade rights, human rights. And this basically is because we don't have sort of contractual expectation-like damages in most systems. So in the trade space, right, the way it works is you get the right to retaliate. You only get that right prospectively. It's not retrospective. Other parts of international law do better at this, right? So investment does better than trade because an investor can actually get monetary damages that are backwards looking. But in most cases, this is still not going to approach a complete remedy. And so what that means is that when you have a violation of international law, particularly an interstate dispute, so maybe we want to put human rights to one side, although maybe not. When you have an interstate dispute, at least, you are going to have a net loss to the parties jointly if there's a violation. And that net loss is going to result from the imposition of sanctions, which is usually going to be costly to both sides. It could be reputational, that is, a reputational loss to the side that violates an international agreement does not come back in the form of some benefit to the party, to the aggrieved party, right? They don't get anything from that. Maybe they get a little bit of information, but that's about it. And so you're suffering a joint loss from the parties. And so there's an argument that undeterrable violations should effectively be subject of exceptions. That's when you should step in and say, look, the role of, in this case, GATT 21 would be to legalize those kinds of violations that cannot be constrained by the system. And I think actually this makes a lot of sense if you think about the nation-based use of the national security exception. When the British and the Argentinians were fighting in the 1980s, When Yugoslavia was falling apart, when the United States felt threatened by the internal politics in Cuba or Nicaragua, it just wasn't going to, the GATT wasn't going to stop whatever was going to happen in those kinds of situations. And so there's an argument there that 21 should operate in those situations to come in and basically take this out of the sort of purview of the GATT. We shouldn't view those as GATT violations because they're not, the GATT cannot deter them, and viewing them as GATT violations just results in a joint loss to the parties. That would be the ordinary use that is this nation-based use, what I think of as the predominant use of the national security exception during the Cold War, would be justified on these loss avoidance grounds. There's a third function that exceptions can play, though. And here is, and I'll try to wrap this up in a few minutes so we've got time for questions. Here's where I think that we really run into a problem with the way the national security exception is being invoked with respect to these kinds of product-based regulations. And the third function is what I think of as the channeling function. And so the channeling function works basically this way. In any country, there's going to be a certain amount of pressure from various constituencies for protectionism. And we could think more generally that there's going to be a certain amount of pressure for violation of any kind of international right. Right. So if we were talking about the environment, there's going to be pressure for countries to emit more, right, for economic regulations that are going to allow greater emissions. But to stick with the trade example, there's going to be pressure for protectionism. And those industries that are interested in seeking protection are going to presumably hire lawyers and lobbyists that are sufficiently sophisticated that they will try to build coalitions domestically for that will justify or be successful in enacting protectionist measures. And so just to give you an example of an ongoing dispute about this, the EU has used trade remedies more or less to close its domestic biofuels markets to Indonesia and Argentina because the EU wanted to. There was a very important green movement within the EU that said we need to move over to renewable energy in order to save the environment. And there was also a thought that, hey, when we do that, what's going to happen is we're going to really give a shot in the arm to the to EU agriculture, because that's where the stock for these biofuels is going to come from. And that second part turned out to be wrong, because Argentina and Indonesia were able to supply biofuels at a much lower cost. And so the EU then stepped in and provided protection for its domestic producers. We could have a long conversation about whether or not that was justified and on what grounds. But the point is that this is what, in political science in the United States, we sometimes refer to as a Baptist bootlegger coalition. The idea is that you have two people that basically don't agree, who are able to agree on a specific policy. The origin of the expression is that in many states in the United States, it's illegal to buy alcohol on Sunday. And so the Baptists, the religious groups, were in favor of this law because they didn't want people drinking on Sundays when they should be in church. But the bootleggers, the people who wanted to sell illegal alcohol, were also in favor of this law because they wanted more business from people that couldn't buy beer and alcohol legally on Sundays. Okay, so we speak of these kinds of Baptist bootlegger coalitions. And that's the kind of core concept of this channeling function, right? That pressure for protectionism, whoever those organizations are, they're out there looking for somebody to partner with. And in today's environment, it is often going to be environmental groups, but it might also be human rights groups, where they're going to come to, this is very clear in the labor and environment chapters of trade agreements, where you see labor organizations coming together to all of a sudden be very concerned about labor conditions in Mexico. Does the AFL-CIO, the leading labor union in the United States, do they really care about labor conditions in Latin America? I've asked them this. They say they do. I believe they do, but I don't think that's what's driving it. I think what's driving it is that if they think if you raise environmental and labor standards in those countries, right, it will give an advantage to American workers, right? So you see protection basically looking for partners. The problem with the national security exception is that the pressures for protection today, although we continue to see these kinds of environmental interests, and we see human rights interests, and we can think of labor as perhaps fitting kind of in that human rights bucket, the major concern in a lot of developed countries today is one about economic equality and economic opportunity. In the United States, I would get attacked for saying economic equality because maybe that's not what it is. Maybe it's about opportunity. Maybe it's about fairness. So I'm not wedded to a particular notion of what economic justice requires. I'm simply noting that in many countries, there is a sense that whatever it requires, it is not present. I think this is, you see this in Britain, perhaps, with Brexit. You certainly see it in the United States. And so you have one of these coalitions that is ready built between industries that are seeking protection, a legal justification for national security, and the idea that we can protect these what often have sort of deep national or communal attachments to industries like steel, like autos, that you're able to sort of put together a coalition there that is really about that. It's really about economic this notion of economic justice or economic fairness, but it relies on this partnership with a kind of national security slash protectionist rationale. And that is the part that the existing national security exception is very poorly adapted to handle. I think national security works fine for these kinds of loss avoidance situations, the kind of nation-based regulations where it's a foreign policy issue and we're going to do it regardless of what the GATT or the WTO tells us. I think it does a very, very poor job in these kinds of channeling situations where the absence of any kind of exception for matters of economic justice basically funnels what are really disputes about economic justice into the national security box, because that's the one that is largely unconstrained, and we've got to find a way out of that box. I want to leave time for questions, so I'm not going to say much about how we might do that. But I think just briefly, two ideas would be fairly bravely tried to do in the Russia dispute, which is to actually have some kind of judicial review of Article 21 that tries to sort through what the government is actually doing. That's a potentially dangerous exercise because governments are not fond of having their national security justifications reviewed. But it is something that at least in a more stable geopolitical environment might work. I'm not sure we have the right conditions for it today. The other possibility is, of course, just having economic justice type obligations within trade agreements going forward. And I think this is probably the most straightforward way, because if you created some space for economic justice considerations within trade agreements, that you then channel those kinds of disputes into those justifications rather than into national security justifications. And I'll end with this thought. The clearest benefit of that, aside from just the economic justice concerns themselves, is that it takes national security off the table as this potential regime-destroying exception. That is, Mona Pinchas-Paulson has written an excellent paper that sort of studies the origins of GATT Article 21. And basically, at the beginning, particularly within the U.S., there was a lot of concern that GATT 21 was going to swallow the entire trading system. And it didn't happen for years. And when we start seeing these steel disputes come down the line against the United States, I think we'll be back in that moment when it could. And the real benefit of creating an economic justice exception or set of obligations, it could be framed a variety of different ways, is going to be that it redirects a lot of that attention away from the national security exception and allows the national security exception to play what I think is its proper function, which is excusing foreign policy-based invocations of national security. And I'll stop there and leave about 15 minutes for questions. So thank you all very much.